I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the four most populous counties in Kansas, voters don't have a voice in choosing their election commissioners. That honor is done by appointment by the Secretary of State. Today, a look at why some say it's time for a change. Two members of the Johnson County Board of Commissioners give their thoughts on if and why selection should be given to voters and what a revamped system should look like. Then, the legendary career of Marion Washington. She was more than just a KU women's basketball coach who says her time there was pivotal to her many accomplishments. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Johnson County has a new election commissioner. Not that voters had anything to say about it. Kansas Secretary of State Scott Schwab has appointed former election czar Connie Schmidt to the job. She held the position from 1994 to 2005. But some officials are saying it's time to change the way we appoint the election commissioner. In all but four of Kansas's counties, voters elect a county clerk to oversee elections. But in Johnson County and the state's three other most populous counties, Wyandotte, Sedgwick, and Shawnee, the Secretary of State appoints an election commissioner to a four-year term. Critics say that the process overlooks the will of voters who foot the bill for the office to begin with. Now, a conversation about the selection process for Johnson County's election commissioner and whether it needs to change. With us are two members of the Johnson County Board of County Commissioners who have differing views on this. Janae Hanslick is the 4th District Commissioner. Janae, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Michael Ashcraft represents the 5th District. Michael, nice to have you too.
Thanks, Steve.
Can either of you explain why Kansas uses a fractured system for appointing election commissioners? I mean, why is it that voters elect someone to handle elections in all but four Kansas counties, and the counties where the Secretary of State appoints that person happen to be the largest four counties by population in the entire state, Janae?
Well, I think it goes back a long way in history when this Kansas law was passed that says that any county with more than 130,000 residents will have an election commissioner appointed by the Secretary of State. Unfortunately, in this day and age, when we have so much technology, we have so many election issues that really require a skilled professional person, this system no longer works. When you have a county like Johnson County with over 600,000 people, we have to have someone who has experience and who knows what they're doing in this position.
So you're saying the evolution of technology, the evolution of our society has sort of changed the demands of the position, and that changes how we should select that person.
Absolutely. I believe we need to have someone who has that background and experience. I equate it to our appraiser, for example. There are counties in the country that elect an appraiser, and that person could have absolutely no experience. And so what the county has to do is hire someone who actually knows how to run the office. And I equate it to the same thing with the election commissioner.
Michael, you don't view it that way. Why not?
Well, clarification, Steve, if I could, because some of my friends are for the current system and some of my friends are against. And well, I always try to support my friends, okay? Mm-hmm. The question is, what is good public policy in this area? And the issue for me is, what are the checks and balances and what are the separation and duties so that whoever is the election commissioner is not exposed to undue influence, whether it be individuals running for office, making campaign contributions, or people who are interested in pursuing their own agendas and policies. Mm-hmm. And That's the issue, because in Kansas we do have you call it a fractured system, and I think that might be a way of describing it. But back in 2013, the Election Law Journal published a report that talked about the differences between large counties or large election operations and small. And by most any measure, Johnson County is the largest one in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And they talked about there being a need to manage and organize those larger counties differently because, as Janae just pointed out, the complexities with technology and with the different elections, because many of the smaller counties in Kansas maybe have two elections a year. We have mail elections and special district elections, city elections, and so forth.
Right.
And it requires a level of complexity. And I think Janae is right. There are some flaws in the current structure, and one of which, Janae didn't say it directly, but she did imply it. We are actually functioning under what I would charitably describe as antiquated statutes that were created when Kansas was a rural farming agrarian
right.
State. And Johnson County has matured a lot. But back in the day when this first was created, those commissioners, whoever was appointed or elected, had to reside in the county for, I think it was 2 years, wasn't it, Janae?
2 years, yes.
2 years.
That's the requirement.
And for us, a complex, dynamic, high-technology environment as it is, that pool of people who have actual election experience, professional experience, is pretty small.
So given that, then, how do you see the path forward? Is it status quo, or given the complexities of the job that you're outlining here, do we need to change the system to ensure that we get people who know what they're doing?
Well, some of my friends have suggested that a basic change would be to change the statute so that counties like Johnson and I think Wyandotte, Sedgwick, and Shawnee. And someone told me that Douglas will soon be in that 130 category.
I think they're the next up.
Yeah, that they should have the flexibility to seek professional individuals that have real experience in elections, and particularly elections security and elections technology.
And what would that look like? Does that mean an appointment process? Does it mean, would you prefer an election process, Michael? How do you see it?
Well, I don't know that I really have a dog in the fight, but the National Conference of State Legislatures a few years ago did an analysis of the different kind of selection processes for election officials.
Mm-hmm.
And in Kansas, we are one of 24 states, not quite the majority, but by far the largest grouping that allow the Secretary of State to appoint for large counties, large complex counties, the election commissioners. And part of the rationale is, and honestly, I haven't researched it, but if you look at the literature, one of the things they say is it allows for a centralized, meaningful organization of all election practices and procedures so that, quite honestly, if something goes wrong, you have one person you can sue, or one entity, which mm-hmm. would be the Secretary of State. Otherwise, they argue, you have all these disparate organizations that can do it their own way, and you have multiple suits and multiple problems. And to build on that, a woman named Tracy Campbell, back in 2005, wrote a book called Deliver the Vote, The History of Fraud in the United States, and kind of went through all the states that have had problems with their local jurisdictions mm-hmm. who were, I'll use the term renegade, I don't think she used that term, but were renegades that got into election problems. States like North Carolina, New York, Oklahoma, Arizona, California, Texas, Florida, and the list goes on.
Okay. Janae, let me swing back to you then. So the process going forward, as far as you see it, would be what then?
Well, I think first of all, Steve, to me, it becomes an issue of local control. I think that's really what it boils down to, because even as Michael said, the current system would allow suits against one person. The problem is it means that one person can make a decision, and that person might be very thoughtful and make mm-hmm. a very thoughtful decision to have a qualified person, or they could make a purely political decision.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever that decision is of that one person, an entire county has to live with that. And so there are so many pitfalls with our current situation because it does allow the selection to be made on a purely political basis. It precludes, as Michael said, a national search for an actual experienced, qualified person.
But I'm just sort of wondering, is there any way to wring all the politics out of this process? And a lot of experts will say probably not. If you bring the decision home and allow voters to pick, that would carry with it, as Michael is suggesting, a certain level of politics. If you let the Board of County Commissioners, you all make this decision, that wouldn't necessarily mean that politics aren't a part of this either.
Sure.
And so I'm just wondering, so what is the path forward?
Well, I am envisioning a system very similar to what we do in choosing our district court judges. And that would be, we would have an election commissioner nominating commission made up of members who are appointed by the county commissioners, just as we have appointments to many other boards and commissions. And those folks on that commission would review the applications. They would interview the applicants. They could do a nationwide search. And then they would recommend maybe two or three nonpartisan candidates to the Board of County Commissioners for final selection.
Sort of like, yeah, sort of the nonpartisan selection
yes.
process we have for judges now, you're
yes.
saying, across the state of
yes.
Kansas and Missouri, for that matter.
Yes.
Michael, what do you make of that idea?
Well, I think public scrutiny in the selection process is critical. Genève's approach is a valid one, but the question we have is the system that we currently have, is it irreparably broken now? Because some of my friends, again, would argue that, well, right now, the way it's organized is there is a checks and balance approach. You have a Secretary of State that makes an appointment, but the county commission on a long-term basis reviews the budget, is aware of the operation, and intervenes in each election cycle to give that balance. So the system works as it currently exists.
But the argument is that the commissioner of elections here locally, elections are paid for by local taxpayers who have no say over the person who is appointed to guide that system going forward.
And
there's no buy-in here from local voters.
But is that a bad idea? Because the intent is to make sure the election commissioner, and as Genève pointed out, the assessor and certain key positions are independent, that they are not under the influence of those local interests, those local political interests, those local money interests.
Mm-hmm.
Steve,
sure.
I would offer that, in fact, our system is broken because we saw this just a number of years ago that because we have no local control over terminating an election commissioner who's not performing well, or even worse, is making questionable financial and personnel decisions.
Yes.
We experienced that with Johnson County Election Commissioner Brian Newby.
A lot of controversy
yes.
involved in his time
yes.
in office. Right.
And even though the county commission, as I understand it, at that time raised this issue with the Secretary of State, it ultimately was the Secretary of State's decision how to handle that personnel situation.
Mm-hmm.
So the county was left to deal with the fallout, and even having control over the budget was not enough to address that situation. And we're very fortunate right now that Secretary of State Scott Schwab has been, I think, very thoughtful and
collaborative. From everything I read, right.
And I think the solution we have currently is a good one, and I'm very supportive of that. But I still think we shouldn't have to do all this machination, yes, in order to come out with a good solution.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about how Johnson County winds up with the head of its election system. Right now, the state Secretary of State makes that appointment. We're debating whether that's a good idea or not with Janae Hanslick, who's the 4th District County Commissioner, and Michael Ashcraft, who represents the 5th District. If we were to make a change, are we talking about a statutory change or a constitutional amendment here? Janae, any thought on that?
It would have to be a statutory change because the current system is defined by Kansas law in statute. So it would be up to the legislature. And I know there actually is currently a bill in the legislature that would make this kind of change. Of course, right now, nothing's moving in the Kansas legislature, so I don't anticipate any changes
this
year. Don't
you know? Yeah. Michael, how much interest is there back home here in an idea like the one Janae is throwing out for sort of a nonpartisan nominating commission, if you will, for an election commissioner? Have you guys discussed it at the county board level yet?
Well, a couple things, Steve. Let me make clear, neither Janae or I are here as representatives of the board. We're just here as representatives of as individual commissioners. And no, there hasn't been. But I wanted to go back to a point that Janae made about a previous commissioner, that there were some issues.
Brian Newby, we're talking about.
Yes. Janae sees that as problematic, but I would suggest that that actually shows how the system works. The county, removed from the actual election process, cannot interfere in those elections, but can monitor and understand and then report the issues to the Secretary of State or whoever the cogent authority is. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that that shows how it works. Now, could it work better? Possibly, but, you know, democracies are messy things sometimes, mm-hmm, and that separation of power, those checks and balances, are intended to encourage that debate, because sometimes, heaven forbid, a county commission could be wrong, and sometimes a Secretary of State could be wrong.
Right.
But if they can balance each other and then enter into discussions, and for better or worse, we got a resolution. I was there when it transpired. Could it have been cleaner and quicker? Possibly, but we are moving through the system, and I don't think any election was really tampered with, violated, or undermined. Mm-hmm. But there were other issues that came into play.
You know, you've already mentioned here, Janae, that in the short term, Connie Schmidt, the former election commissioner from 1994 to 2005, is going to handle the election commissioner duties. Again, the Secretary of State, Scott Schwab, made that pick. How is that selection going over?
Well, of what I've heard so far from just general comments on social media, that people were satisfied with that outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also heard that there's a lot of interest in seeing the system fixed, because, again, we're fortunate right now to have a Secretary of State who was willing to be collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
That may not always be the case. And so this, in the short term, this has been a good outcome, but in the long term, how do we make sure that we don't have these issues? And the other thing that I'd mention, Steve, that we haven't mentioned is the cost of this system. If we have to have someone who, for example, if a Secretary of State would choose someone on a purely political basis who has no experience or skill, then the county really has to pay to have someone else or other staff people to run the office, mm-hmm, rather than a figurehead. The other issue is when the as in the case with Brian Newby, there was some questionable spending of money that the county can't control that person. It's only the Secretary of State.
I should point out that Connie Schmidt will do this job until January. And at that point, Fred Sherman, the city clerk for Westwood's going to take over here. Any issues with Fred, who I guess happens to be my city clerk in the little town I live in, Michael? Any thoughts about Fred Sherman taking over?
Well, Fred Sherman has the benefit of being married to Susan Sherman, the assistant city manager in Olathe. And I've had the pleasure of knowing Susan and Fred for almost 20 years. And he is a solid professional. He doesn't, unfortunately, have, I think, direct experience in elections, but he does in administration, and he's sharp. And I think the transition plan that the Secretary of State Schwab is putting forward makes a lot of sense.
To allow Connie Schmidt to sort of train Fred in the ways of elections here.
And my understanding is, and I believe it's true, I think Janae said this, that Connie had a history of integrity and is very knowledgeable.
Yes.
So it should be, knock on wood, a smooth transition. But it's a big election year, as we all know.
I was going to say, while we're on this topic here, Janae, we've had some problems with timely election results in Johnson County. You go back to 2008, there was this all-night delay in the county releasing primary election results from that August. The election commissioner at the time, Ronnie Metzger, said he was embarrassed for the county. He was working with new machines that cost $10.5 million, and there were still issues. So I guess I'm wondering, how prepared do you think the county is for what could be a massive turnout in November?
Well, because I'm not a technology expert, I can't speak to the nuts and bolts of that. But I do think that because we have been using these machines for a couple years, and frankly, I have asked a lot of questions about how these machines work, and have been very active in making sure that we're doing everything we can.
And you're satisfied, it sounds like.
At this point, I am. There are always still questions out there, like our poll pads that there's questions about those. But I think at this point we're not starting with a new set of machines like we were before.
Michael, do you share that sense of optimism from your colleague here?
Yeah, we'll be fine. I just personally, though, would offer the perspective. In preparing for this interview, I found an article talking by a guy named King called Waiting to Vote. And he kind of chastened Americans generally that we have such a culture of instant gratification, that we are so interested in expediency that we are willing at some times to sacrifice the veracity of the system. And you're right, there were delays during that election, but as far as I know, there was never any question about all the votes being cast and
counted.
Janae got elected, and I got elected, and the world's at peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I would suggest that knowledge of the technology and the complications of large election organizations like in Johnson County, and this age of the China hacker mentality, and not to cast aspersions on China, but if you look at the press, a lot of that comes from there, or the Soviets, or I guess they're not Soviets anymore, the Russians. We need to have that type of professionalism, and the county organization right now, our IT department, supports that technology. And that's been a big transition, because in the past, we didn't. And we are trying to integrate that and support it.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our two Johnson County members of the Board of Commissioners for coming in today. Janae Hanslick, the 4th District Commissioner. Michael Ashcraft represents the 5th District. Thank you both very much.
Thank you,
appreciate
Steve.
It.
Thank you, Steve.
After a short break, when we come back, we're going to talk to a legend, Marion Washington, who coached KU women's basketball for 31 years. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tune in tomorrow, and we'll learn about two of Missouri's historically black universities and the financial hill they've been climbing in recent years. We'll find out what's behind their struggle. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's tough to imagine that one human being could rack up as many accomplishments as Marion Washington. She was KU's head women's basketball coach for 31 seasons, recording 17 20-win seasons. She coached KU to 7 league championships and 6 conference tournament championships. She was Conference Coach of the Year 3 times. She was also the first African-American to coach on an Olympic women's basketball staff, and she was inducted into the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame in 2000. And the list tends to go on and on here. With February serving as Black History Month and March as Women's History Month, we thought it would be a good time to catch up with Coach Marion Washington, who joins us this morning via Skype from St. Augustine, Florida. Coach, so pleased to have you. Good morning.
Well, good morning, Steve, and thank you for inviting me.
You know, one thing that many people may not recall about you amidst all of these accomplishments is that at Kansas, you were the first and only athletics director for women's sports. You served in that role in the 1970s during your first years as head coach of the women's basketball team. You have said that those years laid the foundation for your work at KU going forward. And I'm wondering how so and what happened in those years that you regard as so pivotal?
Well, I think it's important to note that women did not compete intercollegiately at the University of Kansas prior to my getting the directorship. And it was just a real important effort to establish women's programs, women's sports, a competitive schedule, hiring coaches, building facilities, and establishing budgets and scholarships, and it goes on and on. We weren't even a part of the Big Eight conference in the beginning, and to see us now be able to compete and to be so, you know, so talented in so many of our sports. I mean, it's really a blessing, and it's been fun for me to watch.
You know, these were the years not long after Title IX came into being that barred discrimination based on sex and educational programs. How big a difference did Title IX make?
Well, had it not been for Title IX, we would be still what I called at that time a sophisticated intramural program. Hmm. There was nothing that forced universities to identify what was necessary to treat women the same as they were treating the men. We would not have scholarships for women. You know, it really proved to be the only leverage that we had in order to get some of the things that women, you know, deserved. Half of our population, almost half of our population at the on our campus were women. And so it just seemed right to be able to provide them a competitive opportunity.
You've already mentioned you were able to hire a lot of female coaches during those years. How much fun was that, Marion?
Well, I don't want to say it was fun because we really didn't have salaries in which to really pay them. And they weren't all women. In fact, I had a lot of men that coached our women's teams. The stipulation that I had was that if I had to hire a male to coach women, then he had to have a female assistant coach in order to give them an opportunity to grow as a coach. But you know, when I look back, I had some wonderful coaches that really believed in our program. That some of them actually came from a distance in order to train and develop each of their sports. The fact that they worked hard to help me get scholarships available for each of their sports. The only way that we were able to do that in the beginning was to each sport had to have summer camps, and a portion of their monies went in toward their scholarships. Yeah, yeah. And so it kept us able to compete on a not just a state or regional level, but many of us moved into the national level of competition.
You know, how tough of a slog was it in those years to build up women's sports at KU? And I imagine at so many universities around the country, how tough was it?
Well, it was difficult. You had back then three different approaches to the women's challenges. You either was an institution that decided that they were just going to not do anything and wait for the law to determine what really was to happen, or you had schools that just did enough so that they maintained their federal funding. And then you had those schools that decided, look, this is the law, and so we're going to go ahead and do what we're supposed to do. And it ended up separating programs for women. You had, for instance, our program that was able to compete on a national level, but we had then to compete schools that put a lot of money into their women's facilities that we just did not have. So when it came to recruiting, you know, it always was an uphill battle. As you look back and you see what we were able to accomplish, I'm just so proud of what we were able to do.
As you look back at your career, I mean, is that the first thing you would point to, your success in building a women's athletics program at KU, or would you point to something else?
Well, when I think about Kansas, first of all, I'm very proud of the University of Kansas, and my love for it, I think, showed in when I would go into the homes and I'd share, you know, the accomplishments of our men's program and our academic successes. But yes, I would say that the fact that I had a chance on the ground level to build a department with all of our women's sports. I mean, I was the first track and field coach, and track was my second love, and we didn't have track, and yet our men's program was nationally known.
Yes.
And, things like that really helped to make a big difference. Absolutely. When we decided to finally merge and have one umbrella, one athletic director, that was when I decided that I wanted to focus on women's basketball.
Former KU women's basketball coach Marion Washington is my guest. You know, are women's sports at KU today where they need to be? Are women's sports around the country where they finally need to be, Marion?
Oh, I think that we've made incredible progress. I've gone back to watch and see some of the facilities that are available to our women, and I'm just so proud and so happy for those coaches that, you know, they really have just about everything that they need in order to develop their sport. In terms of around the country, we still battle the notion that women's sports is less than our men in terms of what we contribute. And maybe in the back of my mind, it was the one push that I had. I wanted to show that women were able to contribute to our university and our university's notoriety in terms of what we were able to accomplish. And so many of our athletes went on to, compete on the Olympic level. It was an ongoing challenge, or, the kind of media coverage that we had back then. It's better now, but there's still room for more. I might point out that one of the reasons why, and I'm jumping for you, Steve, but one of the reasons why the WNBA became a real possibility was because the NBA had decided that they were going to offer the professional league for women, but they got involved with our 1996 Olympic team. And what they did was they promoted our women's team as they did the men's dream team. And so you saw commercials with our women, our top women athletes, as a part of it. So Lisa Leslie and Cheryl Swoops, they became household names. Our young girls, our young boys, were able to see these top women athletes and identify with them. And so it really, really, it sent us to a whole different level of exposure. And that's the one thing that I felt was always necessary, needed on the collegiate level. We just got to have to constantly help people to know who we are, what our women are doing, mm-hmm. And really get people behind us and continue to be proud of our accomplishments.
Is there any one thing that needs to happen at the collegiate level? One more thing that needs to happen to, you know, push women's sports up the ladder by another notch or two?
Well, you know, there's always something that you can do to promote. There are things that we can leverage so that our alums and our fan base can really feel like they're a part of. And I'll give you an example. Our men and women's basketball teams, we won the last Big Eight, and we won the very first Big 12. And back then, I mean, that's not going to be duplicated again. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. back then, I felt that that was an opportunity to really leverage our women's program along with our men's. And when you have a chance to bring those two programs together, and I'm just using women's and men's basketball as an example, but when you're able to merge those two accomplishments as though they were one, then you have more people that kind of get involved with that. But one of the other big differences has been that our women's fathers have been getting involved mm-hmm. with their daughters. And of course, we lost Kobe just recently, but mm-hmm. Many have said that he would have helped to make a difference in promoting women's girls' sports, and he would have. But it's the, you know, our parents, our fathers that really understand and appreciate and are really excited about their daughters that really help to continue to promote the women's sports.
KU coaching legend Marion Washington is my guest. You know, there's already concern here in Kansas City about the return of the Big 12 women's basketball tournament next month to Kansas City. It's going to take place at almost exactly the same time as the men's tournament. Is it a legitimate concern that the women's tourney will possibly be swamped by the men's tournament?
I think it's not a good thing to have happen. When we played in Kansas City, when our men were playing, we were able to play, you know, in between their dates, so that if you were going to be in Kansas City and you wanted that kind of an experience, an overall athletic experience, you had a chance to go to both of them mm-hmm. and support both teams. So I don't know what the schedule is, Steve, that you're mentioning, but if it coincides, I mean, on the same day, basically the same times, that's not fair to the women at all, because most are going to go to the men's sporting events.
I want to skip ahead to another big moment in your life, Marion. This was being named to the coaching staff for the women's Olympic basketball team back in 96. This is considered to be a big year, 96. You've already alluded to that in the history of women's basketball. Because what? This was the year where things began to sort of turn the corner?
Yes. Well, first of all, it was going to be, it was held in our country, in Atlanta, mm-hmm. Georgia. And that was just a big thing for us. And as I mentioned earlier, you had not just the men's dream team, but now the women basically was a dream team for our country. And people recognized our female athletes. I know that I ran into a family who had apparently entered into the lottery for a men's basketball ticket and ended up getting a women's ticket. Hmm. And they told me that initially they were upset about it, but then they went on to the game and they fell in love with what they saw and just enjoyed the rest of their experience. You know, it was a major time for us. Some of the things that happened, you know, we were not able to stay in the village our men nor our women, because we were generating such such interest. They had to put us in a hotel, and we were located not very far from the facility, and yet we had to be bused there because people were every place. You know, it was just, it was rewarding to see it, to be a part of it. And I'm very thankful that I had that opportunity.
You know, you left coaching in 2004 after, you know, more than three decades of leading KU women's basketball. How hard was it for you to walk away?
Well, it was very difficult. As I look back, I realize part of what happened to me toward the end of my career was a real challenge physically. I didn't realize, you know, I have Lyme disease. I didn't realize what that was and what that was doing to me. And my teams had changed, and it was just, I wasn't enjoying what I had experienced earlier. But I have to tell you that working with my women athletes was just one of the best things in my life. Just competing, you know, I compete to this day in any way I can. So coaching definitely was very difficult for me to walk away from. As I watched the games today, you know, I could just put myself in that coaching position and just in, you know, that's always my perspective. So the recruiting, that's always, you know, I think most coaches will tell you it's that's the hard part of your job. But the coaching, I definitely enjoyed. The women that I coached, Steve, were just fantastic. So many of them have gone on and done some great things in their lives. And I'm very proud of them.
Do you have a chance to meet up with them occasionally?
Oh, yes. So many of them stay in contact with me. They're constantly, now that you have the social medium, you know, on Facebook, they're constantly checking up on me. I have some that actually come and stay with me off and on throughout the year. They've just been very, very, they've been an extended family. They have come together as a sisterhood. That's been fun for me to watch happen. So they stay connected. And, you know, I'm able to see how their families are growing and how they are moving at, academically. So many of them are doctors now, running their own programs. I mean, it's just really been a wonderful, wonderful thing to be a part of, and to have them be so successful. It's just been a joy.
Hey, are you able to watch a basketball game on television and enjoy it for what it is? Or, as you just said a few minutes ago, is your temptation to sort of put yourself back in the coaching box and be sort of running things from that perspective?
Steve, I'll be very honest with you. It was very difficult for me for a few years to watch a game. And I'm so thankful, and maybe it's because of my age now, but I am so thankful that I can now sit back and watch and enjoy. And, you know, I'm always rooting for our Kansas women's teams to be successful. I still, you know, I have a few of my former players that are coaching. I have former staff that have gone on, and they are coaching, and they're doing some great things. I get calls from some of them, you know, just talking the game.
But do you ever yell at the TV, Marion?
I'm sorry?
Do you ever yell at the TV?
I yell at the officials. Yeah.
You never got past that, eh?
I still do that. But yeah, you know, you want the kids to really compete and play hard and to understand that they're representing, you know, more than just themselves. And so, yes, I get very, very emotional sometimes watching some of these games. But the officiating is always the same. You know, I'm going to catch everything that they don't catch and that kind of thing. Like we all do, you know, we're all the sixth player, you know.
Well, that's Marion Washington, the former legendary KU women's basketball coach for 31 seasons. Coach, what a pleasure to have you on the show. I sure appreciate you taking some time with us.
Steve, thank you so much. I appreciate you inviting me, and I really am looking forward to getting back to Kansas real soon here and getting a chance to watch some games.
You bet. Marion Washington joined us via Skype from St. Augustine, Florida. Thursday on the show, hear about the financial woes of Missouri's historically black universities, including Lincoln University over in Jeff City. They may be on the hook for millions of dollars they were supposed to get from the state of Missouri. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.